very special Through the Wind Door Extra, I present to you part one of our first dialogue with other New Century fans. Joining the team of Greg, the Iron Podcaster, and Toby, our very own Captain Oxford, we are now joined by the Horror Hulk. This is White Scar's Team Up. Just a quick preface, this episode is coming out prior to our final two episodes covering Let Them Go, because I wanted to do something nice for Alex, who has having a rough go of it with the everything that is going on. That means obviously that there are spoilers for Let Them Go, but in addition to that, we talk about a few things that could be considered spoilers for most of the other Phase 1 New Century stories, as well as a few movies that I'll list off in the podcast notes. Those caveats out of the way, welcome, listeners, to a brand new segment and a new voice on this podcast. About a week ago, I became aware of the fact that one of the new friends I had made on the School of Movies Discord server was making waves with creating a new blog where he could talk about his favorite movies, in particular, horror movies. And I thought to myself, I know that he's been diligently at work devouring every single one of Alex's books. Let's bring him on to provide some new insights with Let Them Go before we steamroll ahead. I'm very proud to introduce Nick Ord, longtime alumnus of School of Movies and very recent excited participant in all things New Century.
Thank you very much, Greg, and thank you, Toby. Thank you both for having me. Yeah, it's an absolute honor of mine to be involved.
Oh, thank you for coming on board. This is great because Lord knows everyone's going to get tired of listening to our two voices at some point in the future.
Oh, I'm sure not. And I've never got tired of listening to Alex's yet. So so that was my way into this. It all happened so without meaning to harp on too long on the background of my history with Alex and his work. I lived overseas for a long time, including India for nearly 3 years. I had a miserable time in India, really bad. I had all kinds of health issues and personal issues. And when I was at my worst, I was bedridden with a back injury and a stomach problem. I discovered School of Movies and it really sort of saw me through it. And it wasn't until maybe two years after that that I then started just every now and then dropping Alex at the time on Facebook Messenger. And I'm not even on Facebook anymore, but he was kind enough to reply, which again, I was like, wow, this guy must have a lot of listeners. And every now and then chatted and just sort of fell in love with his output, really, and sort of went from there onto obviously him introducing me to his New Century stuff. It took me a while to get there because I was really not au fait with audiobooks. I'd listened to the Harry Potter ones done by Stephen Fry, which I loved. And other than that, I've always been more of a written word sort of kind of guy. So it wasn't until fairly recently that Alex said, oh, well, if you want to read them, just read them. And he sent me the written copies. So I read all those during a week off work. And Greg, as you know, you complimented me on my speed reading. I read pretty much all of them in a week, or maybe 10 days, which was great.
Jesus.
start to finish. And then when it came to the horror movie thing, like I used to like horror films when I was a kid. I used to like old horror films. I liked things like The Evil Dead and Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I used to love them when I was a sort of a teenager or a young tweens. But I really fell out of the horror genre. Just didn't like it anymore. Completely turned against it until stumbling onto the Evil Dead remake in 2013, which. And I must be one of the few people in the world to say this. I absolutely fell in love with it and bombarded the Discord group and Alex to the point where Alex was like, right, okay, put your money where your mouth is. Are you free in like 2 hours? And we'll do a mini School of Movies review right now today. So obviously I was absolutely terrified and panicked. but went ahead.
As we all do.
Yeah. Yeah. And that went really well. And then based on how much I enjoyed that process, I then obviously lockdown kicked in with all this corona nightmare. So I started writing my own. I was writing little mini reviews of films and sending them just to Alex privately. And eventually he said, it's been great practice sending them to me, but maybe it's about time you set them free in the wild and see how they do. So I set up my own little blog called Midnight Movies. If anyone listens to this and fancies checking that out, There's not much on there just yet, just 5 or 6 I put up there. But yeah, if you could give that a read and you enjoy it, that would be fantastic. Yeah, and then as the stars align, that means I've had some podcast experience, or just the one. I've had some experience in reviewing movies. Yeah, I suppose then that brought me to your attention.
Well, that's brilliant. I know exactly what I'm doing as soon as we stop recording today. I'm going to be checking out that blog.
Thank you very much.
For those of you that are interested in hearing more from Nick after listening to our discussion and GeekFest, there will be a link in the podcast description to his WordPress site, which is called Midnight Movies Online, currently holding strong at 11 separate articles with opinions, deconstructions, and explorations of movies both familiar and not.
Well, one thing I've done since obviously we first spoke about a week ago, I took your advice and finally broke my duck on the audio drama thing. So I've listened to the whole Let Them Go audio drama, which, and you, like you said, I'm glad I read it first because I like to let my own imagination do the work first. But with that done, going back and then experiencing the story a second time via the audio drama, it does add some extra perspective, just in sometimes in the intonation and the phrasing and some of the background noises. It's interesting what background noises are used and what are not used, which does make you sort of reassess how I'd already thought about it. Toby, I think it was you that said something that I wrote down in my notes, which I loved at the time, that about creativity breeding creativity. in the Alex and Sharon start out reviewing movies, and that inspires them to start telling their own story, and then that inspires you to do a podcast based on their creativity, and then that inspires me to contact you to do my own stuff based on your... I like that idea of cyclical creativity. That's very inspiring.
That's brilliant, and I'm glad that resonates in that way, because it's exactly what I think anyone putting anything out wants to do, is to kind of... It's all well and good if it makes your day in a little bit like, oh, I enjoyed listening to that. But if it's something which makes someone else say, you know what, I'm going to do my own thing, and it's not going to be the exact same thing, it's going to be a little like evolution of that. It really is the best thing that can come of like creativity as a practice.
Positive Absolutely. Feedback loop was how Sharon termed it when I was talking about the relationship that developed, the fan relationship that developed between me and Alex way back when. As long as there continues to be ongoing good communication, it's a good thing. It's a great thing.
Yeah. And Nick, I was going to say, it's really interesting hearing your perspective as someone who has read the books and now is experiencing at least Let Them Go as an audio drama, and the experience that way around, because I remember once upon a time I was an English literature student, so I did a lot more reading many, many moons ago. These days it is often audiobooks that I turn to first, and with New Century that was just where I went to, because I went from the podcast to, I thought, well, clearly Alex is a dab hand at audio editing, so I'll just go to that. And now finally I've actually read a New Century book before listening to the audio drama, and that will be with Uncivil Outlaw when the audio episodes start releasing relatively soon. So I'll get to see what it's like to go through the experience you did next. So I'm looking forward to that immensely.
I keep wanting to start Uncivil Outlaw and then getting delayed. Firstly, because Alex gave me a little ticking off because I hadn't done the Christmas Thieves. And that's just because I have a thing about only doing Christmas. I have a thing about only doing Christmas at Christmas.
Yeah. That's brilliant. With Uncivil Outlaw, it took me a while to get into it because it was just like a new way of experiencing the story for me. And also because it kind of represented a lot as this, like, the first one of the new stage. And, you know, after doing the interview with Alex and everything like that, it was just something that I wanted to make sure I enjoyed at the right pace, and I didn't sort of push myself into it when I wasn't in the best state of mind to be recipient of it. And then when I eventually did, it was like excellent, and I devoured that over a matter of days rather than weeks, as I would do with some of the other ones.
Yeah, well, I think what I'm going to do now that I've done the audio drama of Let Them Go, I think I'm going to cool my jets on phase 2 and leave Uncivil Outlaw alone for a little while. And I'm going to do the entire phase 1 again on the audio drama and do the Christmas Thieves, rather than trying to rush straight into phase 2 and Uncivil Outlaw. I think I'm going to do phase 1 justice and start when it's ready.
Good, because I was wanting to get into Steamheart immediately after Princess Thieves, but he hadn't even finished putting it out yet at that point. So he's like, no, go on with Christmas Thieves. I don't have the same love of Charles Dickens or Christmas Carol that he does. And so I was uncertain. I was like, well, okay, fine. I don't have anything else to listen to that is as compelling as this. So I'll put it on. And then I get to hear just how well Alex does the Ian McKellen voice. Because he is doing the male version of Merlane, and it's fucking Gandalf.
He is good with his voices.
Yes, he is.
And it's that thing where you will hear him speaking, and I remember in the commentary for an old Futurama episode, I remember someone saying, oh, this is the first scene in which I was talking to myself. And it's because, you've got several voice actors who voice several members of the main cast. And I was thinking to myself, if I go back, when did that happen? Because it must have happened pretty early on.
Nick, did you ever listen to the two-part interview that we did with Alex and Sharon back in the day?
I didn't, no. Where can I find that?
It should be, you'll have to scroll back in the Patreon feed. I believe it came out in November/December of 2019. There's some good stuff in here. It's basically Through the Wind Door beta. We're talking about all of this experience of listening to it rather than reading it and hearing someone talk to themselves using different character voices. One of the best moments that I experienced in that, and that actually got brought up as one of the topics in the conversation, is the warring voices where Alex is both Thomas Arlington and Seth, talking about the different sides about whether humanity can or should be saved. Yeah, it blew me away.
Yeah, I think you can also find those episodes on the actual New Century podcast feed. And I think if you scroll back far enough in the New Century podcast feed, it will be between Secret Rooms Definitive Edition and Steamheart, I think. So that might be a bit easier to find than going through Patreon.
Yeah, unfortunately, Patreon is not very good for finding individual pieces, as I know, because I had to play several tricks with the filters just to download all of the e-reader versions of New Century so that I could review the text as well as the audio, which is where I learned certain things about the different way it's presented through audio or even pieces of text that weren't in the audio drama. So you may not notice this because you'll be so wrapped up in the moment when you listen to it, but there is one section in Let Them Go specifically you may have actually heard us talk about, because I sent you all of the raw Skype files, where there's a great rejoinder from Rebecca where she is talking to Rafe in the flashback, and that is not present in the audio drama. And because I listened to the audio drama first, I didn't know there was anything missing. But because I was checking text versus audio, I was like, oh, that's not here. That's a really great line. And I mentioned it to Alex, and he's like, I didn't realize it wasn't there. I maybe need to go back and see if I can add that point. Because you're right, it is a really good line. all right, so none of this is wasted. We're all fans here, so us doing the fan geek out thing is this is the content that people are here for. But let's drill down a little bit. Being that you're the horror fan and you talked about the things that you like about it and that you got driven away from the genre for a while but then got brought back in with the remake of Evil Dead specifically, tell us more about what you enjoy, what you take away from horror narratives.
So what that Evil Dead remake, in brief, without how to summarize, I'm aware of any danger of me talking about this film. I can go on for a long, long time. And write for a long time. Well, I would say I could direct people to my blog, which the first article that I start my Midnight Movies blog with is Evil Dead. But very simply, in a nutshell, it reminded me the original horror films that I used to love were essentially fantasy films. Fantasy was always my bag. Just to put that in perspective, I've read Lord of the Rings at least 30 times because I used to read it every Christmas. I got it when I was 10 years old for Christmas from my grandparents, and I read it every Christmas for most of my life. It became one of those things you do. And I think that's where the horror genre lost its way because all the best horror films, the same as all the best fantasy films, they're basically good versus evil with a message of hope. There's a clear story to tell and a point to be made. And I think the horror genre lost sight of that until recently. And it's not just Evil Dead that's rediscovered that. I think when you look at films like the recent horror films like The Babadook that have been amazing, they're rediscovering this thing of horror is a way of saying other things. So if you've got a story to be told, whether it's good versus evil, whether it's a political point or a sociological point or something to do with families, horror is just the means to the end. It's not the end itself. That's what I get out of all the best horror, is that sometimes when you shine a direct light, for example, if I was to write a book or make a movie about Donald Trump right now, it would be the most horrible, upsetting, devastating watch, and nobody would want to watch it. A medium like horror can allow you to shine just as terrifying a light on a subject like that, but you're taking one step removed away from the actual thing, which makes it easier to digest.
Like it's creating a safe space to examine these themes.
Perfectly put. Horror creates a safe space to examine very difficult themes that are hard to examine without that safe space. Yeah.
Listening to you talk about it, Nick, the idea of being able to feel fear in a safe space is one I've heard before when reading about people's experiences with horror, and in theory, I can get behind it. Part of the reason why I was reticent to listen to Let Them Go to begin with is because I generally don't do very well with horror narratives. It has to be framed a certain way. I don't get a jolt out of being scared, and when people are screaming or people are afraid and the story is focused on that, it triggers a fight or flight reaction in me, and I can't generally proceed with that. There's a second portion of that, which is the gore, which some horror movies have and some horror movies don't. After getting into Let Them Go, I am slowly becoming open to the possibility of watching more horror movies, particularly the ones that Alex likes. But listening to Let Them Go, it was harder to keep the story at a remove. When I was growing up, I was primarily all about reading over any other form of media. And I have some ability to picture things in my mind, but it's not as fully formed or developed as other people's. That means that when something happens in a book, I can have an emotional reaction to it, but it's muted and it's controllable, and I can dip in and out of it with no problem. Mm-hmm. With the audio drama to Let Them Go, with all of the added stuff, like you just mentioned, the music and the sound effects, there are certain points, and this isn't exclusive to Let Them Go, there are certain points where I am just so overcome by emotion that I can't proceed on to the next thing. I have to stop and process and work my way through it before being able to, like, okay, I can dip back in now and deal with this.
That for me is the biggest strength of Let Them Go. As a starter for the whole New Century universe, that sense of dread and foreboding and tension permeates the entire series. And there are plenty of the books where the Wendigos are hardly even in them. And it's not about scares or monsters at all, some of them. But it's almost, Alex, he does such a good job of setting up the fear of the Wendigos and the tension and that and the monster horror aspect of it in this one, that as long as you read this one first, that carries forward into all the rest of them. And I think that's important that it makes a really powerful statement in this first one, because then he doesn't have to bother later.
Let Them Go really does make one of the things that makes the most emotionally intense is that feeling of loss, that feeling of having lost someone who has been a big part of your life. And the early chapters establish how much history there is between these different characters, and to show them being systematically taken out of Rebecca's life, and yet the pain of all the unresolved issues remaining, even though all the things that she valued of them have been taken away by the Wendigo. I think that feeling carries forward, even in a story as upbeat as The Princess Thieves. There are characters who fear that loss, that idea of something, and more specifically someone that they share history with and who brings a positive difference to their life, no longer being a part of their life.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And I think by starting telling a very dramatic, very tense, intimate story like this first, even though Alex changes genres from book to book, from drama to drama, there is a through line in terms of his authorial voice. So whenever that sense of loss reappears, whenever there's a threat of losing somebody, it takes you back to let them go. And it reawakens those feelings of what it feels like to really lose someone that's actually close to you. And it means that you can talk about loss in a light and playful way in something like The Princess Thieves, or you can talk about it in a kind of removed, almost non-fiction way in the Cartographer's Handbook, but it keeps taking you back to this one. So when you start realizing that people are losing people close to them all over the world in all these different ways, it's all based on this. Like, just, this is what it feels like to lose someone. Now imagine the whole world going through that at once. And that's what I kept thinking in every book moving forward.
Mm-hmm.
You say that Princess Thieves tackles loss in a light and bouncy way. I can't help but think, and this is a long way off at this point, but Princess Thieves does that right up until the point that it takes off the jaunty gentleman thief's mask and shows you what's really going on under the hood. So...
True.
Nice. Yeah. Very, very good phrasing there, Greg. Yeah. I like that.
Oh, under the hood. I didn't even think about that.
But it's more than that. It's the idea that it takes off the jaunty mask and shows you what's going on under the hood. That's exactly what happens in a very specific scene. And
yeah, very, very well put. And he does something similar in Tiger's Eye. I was enjoying Tiger's Eye to a point. My enjoyment doubled when the lions turned up, and I suddenly slapped my head and went, oh, that's what's going on.
Yeah, I see. We're not wanting to have spoilers.
Not to spoil. Yeah.
But we're getting into it anyway, because this is a fan podcast and you're here and we want to talk about everything.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's definitely one of the early conversations I had with Alex in terms of, oh, okay, so we got this kind of a flavor to the story and it's kind of this movie, and then all of a sudden, as you say, the tigers from Albion show up and we're like, oh, okay, so now we're doing Roots, and then we go through all of that and it's like, oh no, actually we're doing Amistad.
Yeah.
Fuck.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. To be honest, as soon as it was the lions from Britain, essentially, that's when my mind, oh, right, we're doing the colonial slavery story. Oh, no. Right, okay. All right. Okay, I'm preparing myself for generational guilt. I'm strapping myself in.
Yeah.
Put the crash helmet on.
It's that feeling of, oh, no, it is yesterday and everything is worse.
Yeah. But just a quick one then, just to finish. I'm just glancing at my notes based on where we started, and I started with this idea of horror versus fantasy. That, well, for me, all the best horror films are just essentially fantasy films. They're basically fantasy films, but with a bit more gore. It's essentially people versus monsters. In this book, I noticed when I was doing the audio drama over the last couple of days, when Timothy's talking about the dragon train that eats the coal and the trees that come to life. I think that was very specifically put in there to put your mind in a fantasy zone before the story gets started. I found that very clever and very subtle, because I think one reason why Alex was so keen to talk to me about the Evil Dead thing was exactly that, because I think he agrees that the line between quality horror films and quality fantasy films is very thin. It tends to be a case of technicalities. Mm-hmm. And I love that scene with Timothy and the dragon trainer. I almost didn't notice it the first time when I read it. It was when I heard it in the audio drama. I went, right, he's painting a picture here. Put your brain in this zone as the and it's right at the start of the book.
We talked about so many things. We never talked about Timothy and the dragon train. That first episode was super long as it was. I had to cut it down from 3 hours of material to just slightly over 2 hours of material. Now I'm glad that it finally gets brought up here at least. This is the point of bringing other people to talk about these stories, because you're going to remember things that we completely forget to.
And it adds so much. It makes me think of the connection between Timothy and Amanda and how they both have these ways of seeing the world. For Amanda, she looks at the dark history of the area around Weirwood and sees it as there's a romance to it. There's a sort of...
I was going to say exciting.
Exciting, that's it. Whereas the others think it's horrifying. And yeah. What I love about this conversation, Nick, and what you're making me reflect on is that I think that the best pieces of genre are the ones that spread themselves so that they do interact and intertwine with aspects of other genres, because no single story will ever be only about itself. It will be about so much more than that. And in order to be that, it has to tap into a whole spectrum of things from the human experience. So I completely agree. And what I've always thought about with horror and why I get drawn to it is that I think of it as like a spectral mystery, that there is some sort of discerning, like, and understanding the things that you can't understand, and whether that's why is the ghost still here, or why do I fear this thing, like the Babadook. I think it's wonderful.
So it's funny, I'm looking at my notes now, and there's something way, way down in my notes that I'm tempted to mention now just because it fits. Speaking about Timothy and Amanda, so I put the headline on these notes as moral punishment and death. In horror film, there's been a great history of basically whether it's the monsters or the people, the victims, a long history of people being punished for various behaviours or aspects of their lives. From Dracula and Dorian Gray get punished for the vanity with immortality. Then you get like kids being punished for sex, alcohol and drugs in the slasher movies in the 70s and 80s. Greed is a big one. You guys have spoken about Crimson Peak a lot. Greed and lust, indulgence. And this goes that there's very few horror films you can look at that don't have some aspect of somebody being punished, whether it's very much above the line, obvious or metaphorically, for some misgiving. And I was thinking that in Let Them Go, that is still there. There's a lot of that going on. But the moral maze is quite intricate and quite complex. It's quite a tangled web. And I just thought, right, let me see if I can unpick this web. And I thought of every character, every single character in the book, what are they being punished for in terms of their deaths? And off the top of my head, Cavendish is punished either for escaping the asylum or possibly being punished for insanity itself. We're looking back at the Victorian era, about a long time ago. Look at Rafe's basically punished for his split loyalty between the two sisters. So I took this approach to every character, and I really struggled. Suddenly, I got to Timothy first and then to Amanda and thought, what are they being punished for? Boldness, they're being punished for weakness. And then I thought, hang on, no, rather than them being punished, Rebecca is taking their punishment on her own shoulders. So they're not being punished. And if you'll indulge me a step further, I had the thought, hang on, maybe Rebecca is the one being punished. So metaphorically, is it possible that Timothy and Amanda are aspects of Rebecca's personality that then die, and she punishes herself for them dying? So if Amanda's her love and loyalty and Timothy is like her, you know, links to the past and her sort of nurturing mother side, she sacrifices a nurturing mother side. She says so. That's why she turns Rafe down. When it comes to Amanda, she sacrifices her potential for love with Rafe. So I ended on this point of Timothy and Amanda being aspect of Rebecca's personality, and that's why she's punished for their deaths, so they don't get punished themselves. I don't know what you think of that.
I think that's bloody brilliant.
Yeah. Definitely fertile ground for further conversation. I would put as a counterpoint, there may be some aspect of her trying to kill that part of herself, and the let them go part of the story is her trying to forgive herself. And when we finally see her again in Steamheart, she has had time to heal. The experience has made her stronger, but it also suddenly allows her to explore parts of her that never got exercised before, which is why she invites James to her bedchamber.
Oh, that's I like that a lot, because I mean, to be honest, that kind of fits in with what I'm saying. You know, one thing I have not been able to get any line on at all until you just said that is the title, Let Them Go. I mean, yeah, it's bold and it sounds very impactful and exciting. I have not been able to unpick that. I think you just did for me, and it fits into what I said about the references. In one of your obviously I re-listened to your podcast that you sent me, Greg, and at one point you talk about the ghostly cough in the other room. And that would also fit into this would tie nicely into it, because obviously if she's hearing the echoes of this cough that aren't really there, I think it would tie into when it says let them go. Let them go means let Timothy and Amanda go. I'm happy to take that as an interpretation.
And I think this tying into your examination of these characters being punished, I think that it is definitely the case that Rebecca is punishing herself. It occurs to me that a lot of these characters they're punishing themselves because they aren't able to move on from things that haven't been said or that have never been fully resolved. You have Aunt Cleo and Rebecca sitting down for tea is this wonderful moment of healing because they haven't actually allowed themselves to do that. And they both blame themselves, and they reach a point where I think they agree to share some of the blame so that they no longer feel like they have to take on everything themselves. And that is the beginning of each of them forgiving themselves and healing and by letting them go. But of course, it gets interrupted by the Wendigo. And it's only by the very end when she actually completes that process of confronting these ghosts of the past and moving forward that she is able to finally forgive herself and finally let them go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
So, Nick, there is something I want to posit for you to see how you interpret or unpack this. You talk about basically loving primarily horror movies that have a supernatural aspect to them, a mythology, the thing that connects it to fantasy stories, movies, books, whatever. Let Them Go is a bit of a crossover in this regard, because it is a monster narrative, but there are three monsters present. There is the definitely supernatural monster of the Barghest. Mm-hmm. There is the very human monster, as embodied by Dawson, and then there is the, we don't know if it's supernatural or not, but it is still real in the monster that is within Rebecca, the thing that she has the final confrontation with in Thy Shade.
I could draw a very easy comparison with that, actually. Have you all seen The Shining?
Yeah.
So, you know, in the Shining, you have the monster outside, which is the weather that's trapping them in and threatening their lives in the first place. And then you have the husband, Jack Torrance, who could just be losing his mind and threatening his family. And then you have the supernatural threat. So I think it's a very similar comparison of three monsters basically representing the same thing. I've got a whole list of these because Alex is too clever with his movie knowledge and his movie references to do these kind of things by accident. And that was one that I came up with that I would definitely draw that comparison, and not just in The Shining. I mean, I've got a few. Have you seen The Mist?
This is the one. I think it's, first of all, it's based on a Stephen King thing, and it has the incredibly tragic ending.
Yeah, it has the ending is not in the book. The way it goes, the story goes with The Mist that the chap who directed Shawshank Redemption, whose name escapes me, has gone from my mind.
The actor or the
the director.
crap, who was the director of The Shawshank Redemption? It's one of my favorite movies. And even
he did The Green Mile as well. He's a big Stephen King collaborator. Let me just bring this up.
Frank Darabont.
Yeah. There we go. Apparently, Frank Darabont had the idea for this super, super dark ending. And the studio said, basically, you can have this ending, but only if you cut the budget for the film in half. And he chose the ending because the studio wanted the original ending from the book, which isn't dark. But in terms of the story itself, again, you've got three monsters. You've got the monster, which is the mist, which is just like the weather in The Shining, is what's the unknown, scary because it's, we don't know what it is. Then you've got the actual monster. It's the monsters themselves, which show up later. And then you've got the insidious threat of the groups inside this supermarket led by this horrible preacher woman. I think it's a recurring trope of having these three monsters that are basically, one of them is fear of the unknown. One of them is a very real physical, real world threat. And then you've got this slightly supernatural, slightly intellectual, mysterious threat as well. And I think that's very much intentional on Alex's part. Mm.
It's almost as if these three are fear of the beast or the nature, fear of the rival, i.e. the sort of human, uncontrollable other person in the room, and then fear of the self, or fear of what is you don't understand, that you don't have a name for, that might come from within.
Yeah, exactly. And then just to throw in this curveball, you've mentioned Dawson a few times. I don't think I see Dawson quite as reprehensible as I think you guys do, purely because I see him as quite a pathetic figure. And again, when I was looking at, well, obviously you asked me to come in and just consider Let Them Go from a horror sort of perspective. When I thought about Dawson, here's what came to mind for me. The first one, you must have seen Aliens, I'm assuming.
Yes.
We bring it up once or twice.
So a combination of Burke and what's his face, and Gorman from Aliens. You got that kind of spineless, selfish sort of corporate interest, that kind of figure. I also thought of Walter Peck from Ghostbusters. He reminded me of him. Again, as kind of this, I refuse to believe this is real, disbelief to a point of aggression. I saw Dawson as more of a figure of ridicule. Obviously, he's a loathsome person. But I found it interesting that when we were talking earlier, you mentioned him in the light of like Trump or Boris. I never found him that threatening. I found him more frustratingly ridiculous and impossible to reason with.
The moment Nick is referring to is an edited-in aside added to one of the Let Them Go episodes that will have already been published by now. At time of recording, that episode hadn't been released yet, so I was wanting to share what I thought was a clever bit. By the time this extra is going out, Trump has been summoning up the National Guard to use force against non-violent Black Lives Matter protests, and trying to encourage his far-right zealots to also attack these same protesters. While Trump has done many things that are worthy of ridicule, I am still very much afraid of someone that has that much power at his beck and call, even if he would never pick up a gun himself. As far as Dawson is concerned, part of what makes him dangerous is two things. The thing that Toby originally pointed out is that Dawson may be a weak person in terms of being able to decide what to do, but he's very physically imposing. So he has a strength that could be used against Rebecca, and that's part of the reason why we're scared for her, because she needs, well, doesn't necessarily need that strength, but it is something that could so very easily turn on her if she doesn't manage Dawson very carefully.
Yeah.
The other reason why Dawson has the power he does is that he is still a representative of the old world, and because they don't know that this is going on everywhere else in the world, she also has to manage him from the perspective of he could somehow deny her the properties that would enable her to have agency once this is all over and done with.
Of course, because he's a lawyer, isn't he? I'd put that aside. Yeah, I'd forgotten that.
If we're talking about someone that is literally weak, then we have to go to secret rooms and talk about Mayor Buck.
We have fun with him, or at him, rather. But it's also, I think, after he gets scratched and bitten by Amanda, he actually says how when help comes, he will probably try and get her sent to an asylum or something of that sort. So it is very much a case of, even if they all survive this, even if they don't get their access to the properties, he does have that ability to lock Amanda away and throw away the key.
I was just going to say, I had such a sense of disappointment with the way his arc, his story finished, because there was one moment when he seemed to be saying, for the greater good, I will go out there and I will get the trade and I will bring back help. And I think part of me, maybe not expected, but maybe hoped that he had some redemption coming, and that maybe at some point before the end of this tale, he would sacrifice himself for Rebecca or for Amanda or something and show that he had a good side underneath. And when that didn't happen, I couldn't help but think, oh, what a shame. It's like, Dawson, you knew you were bitten, you knew you were turning. The path was there for you to see a shining light and have a redemption arc. Obviously he didn't, but I did find that disappointing.
He probably felt himself invulnerable, because while many people assume themselves the hero of their own story, it's especially true of men of that era and of any era. It's the same reason why in zombie narratives, they're like, I'll survive this bite, I'm special.
Which happens in a lot of zombie narratives.
Yes. Yeah.
I believe Alex actually mentioned offhand on one of the social media outlets that the reason why that doesn't really turn up a lot in New Century is because all the people who did that either died or they ended up killing all the people around them. So it's been 10 years or so. So all the people who were in that position are kind of gone. All the other people kind of know what the score is by this point. But I think as far as Dawson is concerned, and the way that the transformation from human to Wendigo is presented in Let Them Go is fascinating, in that it is very much like something that creeps up on you without you really knowing when the moment comes when you've fully gone Wendigo. And I think that for Dawson, he's becoming increasingly frightened and frustrated, and he's clawing his way to find some sense of control, to the point where when he goes down into the basement, he's can't even remember what he's looking for down there, but he's desperately just trying to find something that will improve their defenses. And then
he was looking
when
for the shotgun shells, I think.
That's right, yeah. And Rebecca, when she picks up the shotgun and he says, put that down, that is kind of when it's something that you can imagine him saying, but it is at that point where, even though he was progressing in a line that seemed reasonable to how his non-Wendigo self might go, the transformation sort of envelops him without it actually becoming clear that it's happening.
Ostensibly, the way it's presented, where he's trying to batter down the door and Rebecca seems to be able to talk him down, it feels like on some level she shouldn't be capable of that, the way it is fully taken hold of him. But we don't see inside Dawson's brain, and maybe him stopping pounding on the door was the last flicker of humanity, rationality left in him, because the next time we see him, he has knocked down the door and he is just in full hunt mode.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm curious about your list, because one of the movies that I invoked when talking about Let Them Go, and something that fits quite well into the three monster narrative that we've built up here, is Pitch Black.
Actually, yes. You mentioned Pitch Black on yours,
We have the monster that is the alien monster of the planet. We have the monster that is Riddick, who is far more complicated as a human monster. And then we have the monster that manifests itself through both Johns, who is the mercenary, and Fry, the pilot.
Is that Radha something, the Australian
Radha Mitchell.
Radha Mitchell, yeah.
Yeah, there is selfishness that is present in both of them. Johns loses his fight with that selfishness, and Fry wins, even though she does so at the cost of her actual life.
Yes, so, exactly. Yeah, totally.
Well, that's what I had immediately in front of me.
Well, there's one. I've still got a few things in front of me, so...
And we'll find out all about the other ideas Nick had and our responses to them next time on Star Trek, the Next Gen... on part two of this episode of White Scar's Team-Up, coming out in 1 week, concurrent with a new episode of Through the Window.